You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Well, thanks for coming out, everyone, on a kind of a crummy day. I'm Tom Gelton from NPR, and I have with me David Reif and Lindsay Holsom and Roger Cohen. And Roger and Lindsay both came from London, so, you know, those of you who are feeling proud of yourselves for having come out today, they came a much further distance. So, you know, it's hard to believe, but 20 years have passed since the outbreak of war in the former Yugoslavia. In May of 1991, in Croatia, a gun battle broke out between Serb and Croat militiamen in the village of Borovo Selo, leaving more than a dozen dead. The Soviet Union was on its last leg. Saddam Hussein had just been defeated by a global coalition. In the first Gulf War, George H.W. Bush had just said he foresaw a new world order in which freedom and respect for human rights find a home among all nations. But not, it seemed, in the former Yugoslavia. 1 year later, after Bosnia was torn apart with the most horrific crimes seen in Europe since World War II, Secretary of State James Baker was still saying, "We don't have a dog in that fight." Almost all of us who covered that fight heard such comments and concluded that it was our duty to make clear the dimensions of crimes committed in Bosnia. Two of the most eloquent voices were David Reif and Roger Cohen. We were all soulmates in that time and place, and it is a thrill to be back with them this evening. I don't need to tell you how they have gone on in the last 20 years to distinguish themselves even more with the quality of their writing and their insight. 3 years after war began in the former Yugoslavia, an even more horrendous slaughter took place in Rwanda, and no journalist played a more important role in bringing that genocide to the attention of the Western world than Lindsay Holsom of ITN Television at that time.
No, I wasn't at that time. I am now. Oh. At that time, I was a struggling freelance.
All right. Well, you were the first English-speaking reporter on the scene. Lindsay had previously been an aid worker in Central America and Africa. And since then, she has gone on to report from basically every conflict zone in the world. Just this month, Lindsay was named Journalist of the Year at the One World Awards. This for her coverage of Gaza, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Congo, where she traveled into the countryside to speak with women who had been raped. I watched that report online. It's available. It's truly moving. She and Roger have both covered the uprisings in Egypt and Libya as well. Lindsay, in fact, just got back from Pakistan. David spent months on end in Iraq. We really have three of the most distinguished war correspondents working today. If anyone's journalism matters, theirs does. But that is the question. Does our journalism matter? Does it influence policy making? And how? And should it? And with the debate over the U.S. and Western response to the Arab uprisings, these questions about our reporting, about how our reporting may shape that response, have great salience right now. Or not. Maybe it's no longer what Lindsay or I or Roger or David say that's important, but what those with an actual stake in the story say on Twitter or Facebook or YouTube. So with that as just kind of a little background, let's open it up to discussion. I want to begin with you, Lindsay. You know, the judges in praising your work at the One World Awards said it reinforces the notion of journalism as a force for progressive change. I don't know how you feel about that characterization, but if in fact journalism can be or is a force for progressive change, how do you see that actually happening? I mean, what does it mean for journalism to be a force for progressive change when it comes to hard policy issues like when and where to intervene in a conflict?
Well, it was awfully nice of the judges to say that, but tragically, I don't think it's true. I cannot think of an occasion when my reporting, I think, has directly made a difference. I can think of occasions when reporting has made a difference. In Britain, maybe one of the clearest ones was even before the war in Bosnia. It was the first Gulf War. There was a very wonderful BBC correspondent called Charles Wheeler, now sadly dead, who reported on the Kurds. And the Prime Minister of the time, John Major, saw this incredible series of reports about the suffering of the Kurds, and that is what led him to set up the safe havens for the Kurdish people, which later became Kurdistan as a separate part of Iraq. So it can make a difference, but I think that it usually only makes a difference when the intervention is humanitarian. And I think that what we saw in Rwanda was that the genocide was too difficult, too complex, nobody understood it, and they were terribly relieved when a lot of refugees fled to the Congo, because then they could come up with a humanitarian response, which was relatively easy. And the other thing which I think we see now is that whatever we report, interest does not go away. Look at the difference between Bahrain and Libya. There's been intervention in Libya, led by the British and the French, more than by the Americans on this occasion. And I'm not saying that's a response to the reporting, but obviously the reporting is part of people knowing and understanding what's going on. But the response on Libya has been completely different from the response on Bahrain. And I've been to both countries, and I can tell you that people in Bahrain are suffering just as much. But of course, British, American, European interests are with Saudi Arabia, or that's how our governments perceive it. They're not going to intervene. Their interests are much more important to them as governments than anything we're going to report.
You know, it's interesting, Lindsay, you say that the situation in Rwanda was so complex, because I would think that the scale of the atrocities there actually sort of simplified that situation. I mean, if you, having been there, saw nuance and complexity there, I would think that must be true in every conflict that we cover. And David, one of the things I admire most about your recent writing is that you call attention to that complexity and the nuance and the difficulty of the choices that we face. Now, you know, we were together in Bosnia. Do you think, David, that we did not pay enough attention to the nuance and complexity in Bosnia? And do you, your book on the Bosnian War was titled Slaughterhouse. Do you look back that on that period of your reporting now and have any second thoughts about the extent to which you were actually an advocate at that time?
No. I mean, Bosnia is one of the few subjects on which I haven't changed my mind in the last 20 years. I mean, I've gone from being a sort of general interventionist by prejudice, anyway, to being largely an anti-interventionist, with the idea that there should be exceptions from time to time on the limiting case principle. But I was never for a humanitarian intervention in Bosnia. I wasn't for an intervention in Bosnia because people were suffering. I was intervention in Bosnia because I thought it was a European interest and an American interest, insofar as the United States remains a European power, to prevent blood regimes, to be citizenship regimes again after 50 years. That I thought that particular body had been laid to rest, and that it mustn't be allowed to. So my sympathies with the Bosnians were political. Now, were there things that we didn't emphasize that the Bosnian government did? Yes, of course there were. But I think I do think the Bosnian War was like the Spanish Civil War. And as someone who knows a fair bit about the Spanish Civil War, the Republic was hardly blameless. Nonetheless, I don't think it was wrong of the people who went, Martha Gellhorn, folks like that, to side with the Republic, despite all those things. If I could add something, though, to Lindsay's point, I agree entirely about the influence. I think the thing I would add is often it's when we, the people who write about these things or film them, when we're effective is when there's a division among the powerful. As I say, Walter Cronkite's reporting worked about the Vietnam War because the American ruling class, to put it bluntly, was divided about the Vietnam War. I think there was some truth to that in Bosnia. I don't have the sense. I was a bit in Rwanda at the very end. I went in with the French, actually, but I didn't. I don't claim to know it well enough to have the right to a view. But I had the impression there was no division in Europe about Rwanda, and therefore
I think there was a division. I think that there was a difference between. I think that the French and the Belgians had a particular view, and everybody else didn't know what the hell was going
on. Well, okay, and but not a strong view the other way, right? I mean, point taken. It should be when there's a side that takes the other view, then your reporting, what you show, can be used by these folks to make their case for intervention, usually, or something.
Roger.
Tom.
Let's go to Libya. You wrote recently about the Western response to the Arab Spring, that we have a strong strategic interest in a Tunis, Tripoli, Cairo democratic example. And I think one of the things that struck me about that observation, and though you have always been eloquent and passionate in your writing, that was really a pretty realistic, cold-headed analysis of the case for taking seriously what was going on there. You did not, like Dennis Ross said, that if we did not intervene in eastern Libya, Benghazi would be Srebrenica on steroids. That was not the case that you made.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Tom. It's great to see you all after 20 years, and hard to believe 20 years have gone by. And I must say, it occurred to me, trying to make my way over here in the pouring rain at the time when taxis change shifts, that it's actually easier to get from London to New York than across town in such conditions. Before I get to Libya, could I just say a word on Bosnia? Because I think it marked us all so much. And I don't agree with Lindsay. I think what was so overwhelming about Bosnia, well, for me, it was a couple of things. I mean, one, it was just seeing all these peoples trapped in some way by their histories, the unresolved history of Yugoslavia in World War II, and seeing how those historical forces could play once the lid of oppressive communist rule had been lifted, this vice-like grip that history seemed to have over people. And the other was just the hypocrisy of the West. I mean, what we were seeing was pretty clear. I mean, people in Sarajevo being shelled day after day, women and children being killed. Roy Gutman and Ed Bartolomei's extraordinary reporting that uncovered the camps in Bosnia. And I think, what did Western leaders want to do throughout? They wanted to find a way to avert their gaze from Bosnia. If they could possibly do nothing about it, if they could possibly say, this is thousand-year-old conflict, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, the number of circumlocutions that came out of the White House and elsewhere. And I think it's only because we all kept drumming away because we were so appalled and so obsessed that, in the end, after Rwanda, finally, there was an intervention. And I remember Rupert Smith in the summer of 95 saying, look, in the end, there's no point hanging around in the middle of somebody else's war. And the intervention worked. It lifted the siege. So I do think that the press reporting, and the press has changed completely in the last 15 years, and that's a whole other subject. But at that time, I wasn't writing opinion journalism then, and sometimes I really felt that, when there was a page one story in the Times, that I could feel the White House was, mm-hmm. I don't think I was, deluding myself, maybe I was, but it felt like there was sometimes quite a direct reaction between some piece and what emerged from there. I mean, since then, we've all been through a lot, including Kosovo, including Iraq, and here we are now with the Arab Spring, and without rehearsing all that, I think I started off from a position, very strongly held position, that we should not get involved in this, that it's so complicated with the West and the Arab world for so many different reasons. And the great thing about what happened in Tunisia, what happened in this tiny little town of Sidi Bouzid that I went to, and with a tiff over a vegetable and fruit cart, and all that led, was that it was indigenous, and it was indigenous. It was homegrown, and it came out of that. And I remember when I saw David, even quite recently in London, I was saying, gosh, I really hope that we don't start getting involved directly in these things. But then, you know, as I watched what was happening in Libya, and as I became convinced that there really would be a massacre in Benghazi if there weren't. And I've since been to Benghazi, and there would have been. I mean, Gaddafi's, you see the point that Gaddafi's troops reached, and it's 20 miles south of the town, and they were there fighting in mid-March. And if there hadn't been the NATO intervention, you know, this would not have stopped. So I do think that there was a powerful humanitarian argument, and the strategic argument that I tried to make with that, you know, that quote you mentioned, is just that I think this is the most extraordinary event we've witnessed for 20 years or so, the Arab Spring. And if we can get, you know, let's shine a light into these societies. Let's close this Arab Jurassic Park, at least in North Africa. And if you can get across from Tunisia all the way to Egypt, that kind of opening, I think that is a very, you know, worthy and important strategic goal.
You know, Roger, you just identified yourself as an opinion journalist, and David, of course, you write books. Lindsay and I are not opinion journalists, and I'm just wondering how significant that difference is when it comes to the impact of our reporting. I mean, as you say, your reporting when before you were an opinion journalist arguably had as much of an impact as perhaps the power of your persuasion does now. What do you think, Lindsay? Do you think that we have, not being opinion journalists, we have an obligation to sort of emphasize or to make clear the complexity of these conflicts in order to be sure, in order to sort of make sure that our reporting is not used by someone as an argument for something?
You can't ever predict how someone's going to use your reporting. And without meaning to be too romantic, I mean, you just try and tell the truth. I mean, that's really all you can do. And you may have strong feelings about whether something should or shouldn't happen, whether there should be intervention or not. And in the end, what you have to be able to say is, they cannot say they didn't know. I told them. I was there. I told them. And that, I think, is really what we have to do. But to put a new dimension into it, when I knew I was going to come and talk tonight, I called a couple of British politicians to try and find out from them to what extent they thought reporting affected their decision-making. And I spoke to quite a senior person in the Foreign Office. And it was quite interesting because he said, well, you know, obviously I get a digest of all the British media, and it's still newspapers more than anything else, which are important. But he said, what really matters to me at the moment is the digest of the Arab press I get every morning, because we have intervened in Libya, and how that is perceived through the Arab world is really one of the most important things, and whether it's, as he would put it, misconstrued, because obviously he's somebody who's got a policy which he's trying to, in a sense, he thought selling the policy to the Arab world was just as important as having a policy which would satisfy British voters and the British Parliament. So I thought that was a very different dimension which we have now, which we wouldn't have had 10 years ago.
David, curious about your thoughts about North Africa, because one of the things that you have written critically about is the lack of historical analysis, for example, in Darfur and other places. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with Roger that what we're seeing in North Africa is truly a historic development? And if that is the case, what implications does that have for the way we write about it?
Well, of course, it's a historic development. The only question is whether it's 1789 or 1848. I mean, that's the. I don't think there's any.
Or 2011.
Or what?
Or 2011.
Well, in the sense of failure and success. Yeah. I mean, I tend to view 1789 as a success. I know in the United States this is not a popular view. But I do think it's important. I don't agree with Roger, of course, about Libya. Not because I wasn't for blunting the arrival of Gaddafi's forces to Benghazi, which I thought was a perfectly good use of military power, but because I think the mission is now one of regime change, pure and simple. You even saw when the fellow who's the interim prime minister, I can't remember his name, was at Brookings the other day, and he said, he was asked about this question, is this intervention, is this military support for you? And basically he said, we're a peaceful revolution, which is such an extraordinary sort of twisting of words. What he means, of course, is his side is the good side. Now, that may well be true, but I think if we're going to intervene militarily, which is very different from Egypt or Tunisia, where I'm all for very active engagement by governments in the West and also by this foundation, which, of course, is very engaged in both Tunisia and in Egypt at the moment. But I think if the military interventions mean is regime change, then no, I don't think that's our business. And I think once you start defining protection as in effect saying the good guys need protection, therefore anytime the good guys are attacked, even if they are combatants, we, the NATO forces, feel we have the mandate under 1970 and 1973 to intervene. I think this twists the thing totally out of any comprehensible or logical thing. Now, had Nicolas Sarkozy or the British Prime Minister or David Cameron wanted to say this is a just war, we are intervening on behalf of the provisional government in Benghazi, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Let them make that case. But this humanitarian justification, and now in its sort of the new version is this responsibility to protect, which of course is mentioned in both 1970 and 1973, blurs war, police work, humanitarian aid, rescue, etc., in ways that I really think could be quite damaging over the longer term. I don't think the question of precedent, and even Gareth Evans, a guy who I think is on the master board here at Soros, or used to be the former Australian foreign minister, former head of the International Crisis Group. Gareth, who I've crossed swords with 1,000 times because I've attacked R2P a lot, he himself has written 2 or 3 articles in the last week saying NATO is pushing R2P to the very limits of what it was meant to be, if not, and risks pushing it over the edge. So again, we could have protected Benghazi without suddenly started trying, frankly, to assassinate Muammar Gaddafi from the air, which is one of the things we've done.
I want to get the discussion a little bit back to journalism as opposed to policy, because I think one of the questions that we face as journalists is whether to emphasize the complexity of these conflicts or to simplify them in order to make clear the true significance of what's going on. I mean, I think in Bosnia, where we're familiar, it would have been easy to write stories in which it was kind of confusing and you can emphasize the sort of misbehavior on all sides, but I think we all felt that there were larger truths that we needed to make clear. I mean,
well, you know, I met with Karadzic a few times, and I really tried hard to see the nice side of Radovan Karadzic, and I tried equally hard with General Mladic, and I didn't manage it, you know, Tom. I tried. No, I think we need to be clear. I mean, we need to be fair. But we need to be clear. I mean, I've always had a hard time with this notion of objectivity. I mean, fairness, yes, but and absolutely a responsibility to report on both sides of an issue. But you also have to think, and you also have a heart, and you bring them together, and you try and bring clarity to an issue. I think that's what journalists should try to do, at least in my view. And you know, I think in Libya, some things, people say, well, you intervene in Libya, what about Syria, you can't do everything, that's obvious. You can't right all the wrongs of the world. But maybe you can write a few. In Bosnia, we sat and watched on the ground for 3 years as the UN and NATO did their pirouette, and people went on being killed. And then, you know, 3.5 years after the great massacres of 1992, which everyone seems to have forgotten today, I mean, it's all Srebrenica, and not to belittle Srebrenica, but, you know, the great massacres, it was a reprise of what had happened at the beginning of the war. I mean, we've gotten better in a way. I think we should, you know, tap ourselves on the back a little bit. I mean, this time around, it was a bit quicker, and much quicker, and we did stop the fall of Benghazi. And, I mean, you know, dude, I'm not gonna shed a tear over Gaddafi, especially.
What about his grandchildren? I mean, what about the? Well,
if you believe that, yeah. Of course, it was the grandchildren.
Well,
yeah. Anyway, maybe.
I mean, but you start bombing people, you start killing children. That's what happens in wars, you know as well as I.
This is true. I mean, Gaddafi's been there 42 years. He's, you know, the more I heard, I mean, I don't know if your experience was the same, Lindsay, but the more I heard on that side, the more the utter brutality of this regime became clear to me. And there is no word in Libya, or there has not been, other than Gaddafi's. And
yeah, but then Robert,
not even call football
it just
players.
Call it just war. Don't hide as the UN. I mean, you were denouncing quite correctly, obviously, in my view, the UN-NATO pirouette. Mm-hmm. But the UN-NATO pirouette was based on the humanitarian mission. Mm-hmm. And that was a pretext for not doing the things that needed to be done.
I think you can claim that that's being followed. I mean, let's do some clever politics. I mean, let's say, as long as Misrata and these things are going on, in a way, I mean, I think it you know, a broad interpretation allows this to continue. And the thing is crumbling. I mean, his wife, he's going to go. It's over for Gaddafi. And I think that will be a good thing. And I think, again, the press, you know, Lindsay's work, everybody's work in, I mean, the Benghazi people, you know, liberated Libya offers at least an outside chance of some kind of decent existence.
But I actually, I felt...
I was wondering what your experience
was. Well, I was 6 weeks in Benghazi, and I began to feel incredibly... I felt guilty. I felt really guilty for our failure to report on Libya in recent years, because I think that in some ways I came to the conclusion that Gaddafi was as bad as Saddam Hussein, and I reported on the... I found all these families of people who had been killed in a massacre at a prison called Abu Salim in 1996, where Sanusi, who is Gaddafi's brother-in-law, had been put in charge of this prison where there had been trouble. There were a lot of political prisoners, and they had been complaining about their rations and so on and so forth. And Sanusi said, kill them. And men went up on the roofs, and they massacred 1,200 people in a prison courtyard, and some on buses. And we didn't bloody report it. Mm. Now, I know it was extremely difficult to get into Libya and so on, but I think that we took Gaddafi as a sort of joke because he looked so weird and dressed like a rock star and all this kind of stuff. And we didn't really take him seriously. But this is an incredibly brutal regime, one of the most, you know, brutal I've come across. And I felt that there was a failure of journalism, that we hadn't been pushing on that for the last 42 years. Well, I couldn't have done it for 42 years, but I could have done it for the last 10 or 20 anyway. But
David, what story went uncovered, do you think, in Libya?
Oh, well, I mean, Lindsay's absolutely right. I did not incidentally mean to be... When Gaddafi goes, and I agree with Roger, he's going, that's fine. I don't think I would have opposed a war against Gaddafi, simply an announcement at number 10 or at the Elysee that we're intervening on the side of this provisional government, we like what they look like, and we're going in. That isn't a problem for me. It's this confusion of humanitarianism, protection, war, and I'm very concerned...
We're going in without
you. Are you being too idealistic? Because this is the realpolitik.
Cool.
The realpolitik of today is that humanitarian intervention is the way that Western governments can do these things. And what happened in Libya was because of the cover provided by the Arab League. And that is purely political. It's because all the other Arab leaders loathed Gaddafi because he tried to kill King Abdullah, and because he called himself, Imam of all the Muslims or something. That did not go down well.
And there'll be nothing in Syria because, of course, the Russians will veto such a resolution, et cetera, et cetera.
But none of this has anything to do with our reporting.
No, but let me ask you, if I could change the subject slightly back to reporting, but you've given only examples where there is at least some moral clarity.
Mm.
Rwanda, Bosnia, Libya, I agree in that sense. I would like this side to win. But after all, most wars, or at least a lot of wars in the world, are not wars where our reporting can identify...
Well, David, you don't even think there's moral clarity in Darfur, right?
Well, I definitely don't think there's moral clarity in Darfur, but take Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. I mean, Sri Lanka was one of the biggest wars of recent times. Sri Lanka was a war between two absolutely vile entities. I mean, Tiger Elam and the government of those two brothers...
Yeah, but then the reporting imperative there is quite difficult but simple, and that's to cover what's happening to the people, and you don't and that's the glory of not being an opinion writer, which is that you are just trying to find out what the hell is going on, and what you are highlighting is what's happening to the people. It doesn't matter. You don't have to take sides, do you?
I'm just saying that it's important to remember that the challenge. I'm just trying to take up Tom's point that the challenge to reporters is not necessarily, you know, whether to simplify or somehow muddy, if I'm taking this, as my mother used to say, borrowing the Quaker phrase, the sense of the meeting, the important things to delineate. The fact is there are a lot of wars. The big war in Congo was like that. The Sri Lankan war was like that. The Ethiopia-Eritrea war was, and think of a lot of very sanguinary engagements that are worth reporting, but where you can't say, as Lindsay and Roger are saying about Gaddafi, which is obviously true, that we should have made that stuff clear. Because there you do have to actually say exactly what's happening to the civilians in the case of the three wars I just mentioned. Well, the two, the Eritrea and Ethiopia, took place away from big civilian centers.
I do think we should say that since Bosnia, at least in my view, and we have, in a sense, become more marginal. I mean, these movements are being driven
by journalists.
Yeah. I mean, these movements are being driven by information. The information gap between ruler and ruled, which was like that, has gone down to this, or maybe it's non-existent.
Well, in poor countries, I mean, China's the counterexample of that.
Yeah, okay, but I'm talking about the Arab Spring, which is a movement of huge historical significance, and it's been driven. There's no way the revolution in Tunisia would have happened without social media. I watched Mubarak. I mean, I don't speak Arabic, but everybody said, the difference, here he was running this police state, this hierarchy, and at every step of the way, and he'd watch Ben Ali, and he'd said, I am not going to let what happened to Ben Ali happen to me. And in exactly the same way, every single speech he made was a week, 4 days, 10 days behind the curve. Mm-hmm. And apparently he was speaking in this very formal Arabic while out there, Facebook, Twitter, it was this very quick, funny, a different language, a different vernacular. And so I think we need to... at once celebrate and acknowledge that our role, and compared, say, to Halberstam, probably in Vietnam, I think there's been, as media has broadened and even the definition itself of media has changed, I think we have to, reconsider in a way what our impact as, trained journalists has been. It's been much, in Sidi Bouzid for 4 or 5 days there was nothing. There was just some there was a little demonstration, and then an image got picked up by Al Jazeera, and it was a snowball.
Al Jazeera, to the extent that the big media have had an impact, Al Jazeera has dwarfed the New York Times.
Absolutely
huge. And the first, the leader of the of the kind of amazing impromptu army that you see in Benghazi riding around on the back of these Toyota pickups and so on. He was Hewlett-Packard's preferred partner in Benghazi, he told me before this happened, and running a business.
Yeah.
And he said the first thing that he was charged with doing. He had some engineering. He actually went to high school near San Francisco. He said his first task, like the day after the uprising began, was to get up on some roof somewhere and wire up some kind of contact with Al Jazeera. I mean, that was their number one priority as a revolutionary movement, was to ensure that they had immediate access to Al Jazeera. So, and, you know, clearly, I mean, you've had this situation. I mean, the Mediterranean is not a huge sea, and you've had, you know, people on one side of it, and they're mainly young, are very much aware of what's going on the other side of it.
I'm curious, you know, in Bosnia, we found ourselves the subject of great pressure, both by the Serbs and by the Bosnians. By the Serbs, who very much opposed outside intervention and wanted us to emphasize the complexity of the conflict and the ancient hatreds, and by the Bosnians, who wanted us to basically report that all of the future of Western civilization was at stake because they favored an intervention, and we were very much the subject of that. I'm curious, in your experience in North Africa, whether in this day and age, whether there is as much of a sense that the outcome of the conflict, the fate of the conflict, depends on what the Western media report about it, or are they sort of sanguine or blasé about it?
Well, certainly if you look at what Syria and Iran, you know, since I was in Tehran in the summer of 2009, you know, virtually nobody's been back. And there is a view among some of these governments that the only way to hang on, to hold on, is one, to kill people, and two, to make sure no journalists get in. So whatever we think, they certainly think we're a problem.
No, that's definitely true. And the converse is also true, in that when I first got into Libya, which was, I suppose, about, you know, 4 or 5 days after the rebels took over in Benghazi, I mean, they definitely saw us as being on their side, whether we saw ourselves as being on their side or not, which I hope we didn't. But they, I mean, there were hotel rooms for free and drivers for free and fixers for free, and everybody was just offering their services, and helping journalists was seen as part of the revolution. It did change, and prices went up tremendously by the time I left. But that was certainly how they viewed it at that point, very much so.
And did they have a sense that the West was not coming to their aid, or coming to their aid? I mean, you know, after all, we are bombing children in Tripoli. I mean, what, you know, what is this? What is,
well,
the sense?
Remember, though, when I mean, I was in France when this. I haven't been in Libya for a very long time, and even then didn't know it well. But when the military support, there was an initial series of strikes that blunted the attacks. In Benghazi, and then there was a sort of falling off of the NATO effort. The Americans launched all those Tomahawks, the British, and then the British and French aviation went in. And then there was less, and the Gaddafi forces counterattacked. And at least in the French press and on French television, there were a lot of people in Benghazi saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, what's going on here?
What was happening basically was, because I was going up to the front line every day, and it was completely ridiculous. Because, I mean, the sad truth is that they are rubbish. They are about the most rubbish fighters that I have ever come across in my whole life. You know,
I totally agree with that.
They are bollocks, as we say in England. You know, they roar around on these technicals, you know, and most of them haven't ever handled a weapon before. And the moment there's a bit of shelling, then they all scarper off. They never fight back. They haven't got a clue. And, I mean, I got to a point where I heard myself saying at one point, there was this young lad, and I said, well, how old are you? And he said, 17. And he said, a bit of my weapon is missing. I said, well, I'm terribly sorry about that. And I said, does your mother know you're here? Because, I mean, and so they want, and this is, I think, a real problem with the intervention, which is that they wanted our governments and armies to do their fighting for them because they were no good at it. Now, that, I think, is a problem.
A couple of weeks, probably 3 weeks or so after you were there, I went down to Ashtabia, which had become, you know, now you can't go all the way to the front, but they've... Yeah. There's a kind of a front line there. Anyway, so they've managed to So I kind of surveyed the scene. There were these Toyotas like parked in a semicircle, you know, around like, you know, over about maybe a mile. And they'd managed to erect one bomb that was maybe, you know, a meter high or something. And they had a couple of trenches. And I mean, it was really just pathetic. But I saw this commander that evening that I mentioned, mm-hmm. the one who was an engineer. And he said, yeah, did you go? Did you see that? He said, oh, I really want to see Bernard-Henri Lévy. Because he came down there and he told me, we have to dig some trenches. And I just want to bring Bernard-Henri Lévy back, you know, and show him what we've done.
Our beautiful berm.
Yeah. Well, somebody pointed out that these guys want Western military equipment, but they've actually right now got better Western military equipment than the Taliban have, and the Taliban have held off the most powerful military coalition on the planet for years and years now, because they know how to fight.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you both have reported this, but that's one of those sort of complexities of this conflict, that it is our obligation to report. I mean, and also the fact that there are some tribal, there's a tribal aspect to this conflict that maybe doesn't play all that well with the democratic uprising.
Well, I came away from Libya thinking it was a lot less tribal than I thought. There are a lot of family connections, and you know, they're absolutely united in saying they don't want Libya to split. And you know, it's very impressive in some ways what's going on there. I mean, they have these committees on the transition period, on law and order, the courts. It's really going to be, assuming Gaddafi goes, it's going to be tabula rasa. And it's interesting, actually, contrasting Egypt. In Egypt, you have some real institutions. You have the army, you have a real middle class. And some people I met in Libya were arguing that, from NGOs, were arguing that it's going to be easier in Libya because it's tabula rasa, there's nothing. I'm not really convinced by that, because I think you do need building blocks for society. And I think Egypt does have some important things going for it. But, you know, the idealism, it's very hard to come away unmoved from Benghazi. The idealism of the people there, the suffering, what they've been through, and this whole kind of Salafist, you know, bullshit. Not to say that there aren't some, but the notion that Gaddafi and Mubarak and all these people have justified their brutal despotism for so long by saying, you know, if not us, the Islamist wave. And a lot has changed in 20 years with respect to Islamism, I think, in the Middle East, and we've been not very good at reporting that.
But I think that the other thing is that, I mean, Gaddafi would like to think that the people have spent all their time reading the Green Book, but actually they've spent the entire time watching quiz shows on satellite television, as far as I can tell. And there was a point where I was asking somebody to translate some graffiti for me, which was on the wall, and it said, this probably works better in Britain than it does here, but it says, Gaddafi, you are the weakest link. And then somebody else came up to me with an incredibly elaborate joke, which had to be explained to me, which was, Gaddafi is on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and he doesn't know the answer to the question, so they say you can phone a friend, so he phones the devil. But even the devil won't give Gaddafi the answer anymore. So, I mean, in that sense, it's a sort of different kind of thing we're talking about, because we're talking about us terribly serious Western journalists and how frightfully important we are. But actually, in terms of impact on society, what I saw in Libya was that those things were really important, that the political situation had atrophied completely, but socially, people had advanced and were watching exactly the same kind of things as people watch in Britain.
But do we know that the conflict in Libya is as important as what's going on in Syria or what's going on in Bahrain or Yemen? I mean, there are these charming aspects of a conflict that sort of are seductive to us, and these characters that you're describing certainly reinforce that. Mm-hmm. But does that mean that that conflict is more important than another? And are we not paying enough attention to Syria, for example?
Well, Syria is tremendously important, but we can't get in. And it's very, very hard to get in. And that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I mean, stories get selected by governments as well as by us. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's important to...
We reported Libya before the intervention, but obviously the intervention makes it a bigger story for all of us, doesn't it?
But it also, I mean, but as you say, you're welcomed in Benghazi, and you can get to Benghazi because it's easy to get to Benghazi. I mean, comparatively easy to get to Benghazi.
Well, now that John Burns has got to Tripoli, you can be sure that Gaddafi is going to fall, because whenever John Burns gets
somebody... Yeah, there's that.
But I think it's been true for 20 years.
I think governments are going to realizing that we aren't as important as maybe we think we are, and as perhaps we're also not as important as we were. Although when it's a question of intervention, we are more important than Al Jazeera, because Al Jazeera isn't going to convince Barack Obama to go along with something.
Well, no, but
the Arab League was extremely important.
No, I agree, but. Remember where it's not working. It's not working where we've been kept out. Mm. So Syria, the Sri Lankans, I mean, this is interest of mine, the brilliant thing that the government in Colombo did was to refuse access to the north.
Yep.
And then they could do what they liked, and to bully the relief agencies, to come back to one of Lindsay's subjects, into never publishing anything denunciatory about what they were doing, and indeed making them back down on a couple of occasions when they did. So, you know, the information game can be played both ways.
And if that actually makes a difference, that sort of underscores the importance of journalism. If all you have to do to contain a conflict is to keep journalists out, or if that's an important part of it, then that certainly proves or suggests that our reporting is very important.
Well, it certainly suggests these governments think it is. I mean, so that should, I mean, surely their views are more important than ours.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Iraq. And David, you spent an awful lot of time in Iraq, but talk about a complicated case, right, where an intervention has not worked out very well, and sort of looking back on it, you know, there has been an awful lot of criticism of the journalism that led up to the Iraq War, and I don't know about
with
during
good
the
reason.
Iraq War, with good reason. And yet, was this the turning point for you, David?
No.
No, the turning point for me was the expulsion of the Serbs from Kosovo. And when the Serbs were expelled from, Serbs and the Roma were expelled from Kosovo, I thought, wait a second, we don't maybe not know what we're doing here. And we shouldn't do things if we don't know what we're doing. We shouldn't launch troops. And I was very much for the Kosovo intervention. And I still, I'm not interested in consistency. I mean, I really am not. I mean, maybe because some philosophy class I took the first year of university.
The hobgoblin of simple minds.
No, forget about Emerson. But we were taught there was a limiting case to any proposition. And I loathed Tony Blair. I thought what he did in Sierra Leone was great. And I'm not letting my principle get in the way of the fact that he broke the RUF. Something that couldn't be done for how many years? So, I mean, there are times when it's fine to do it. I mean, and if you try to make some absolute, that's then you get into Chomsky land, you know. And I don't think that's a very interesting country to be.
We don't
want
to go there. No.
But you know, as far as Iraq went, I think, for me at least, the shock of Iraq was that, you know, the only people who were against the intervention were the. I was very against the intervention and said so. Then I put on a reporter's hat and went to do something else for the New York Times there. But one of the surprises to me was simply that 80% of the country was for the intervention. Mm. I mean, that was just a fact. So you would go across the desert. I was only there the first year when you could travel much more freely. You'd go from Amman driving through to Baghdad. And there was this place you jumped off and you drove across. And in Amman, if you know anyone, if you know Jordan, as we, most of us, I think we all do, you would see your friends and they would talk about American imperialism and this and the other thing and how this was an affront to everything and good and true. And then you get to Iraq. I spent a week with Muqtadar Sadr. I couldn't get him to condemn the intervention. So, you know, at that point you start saying, well, you know, talk about complicated, but not in the opposite sense, if you will. I still think it wasn't the business of the United States to overthrow Saddam Hussein, but I say that as an American. I would not necessarily... I think if I'd been an Iraqi, I would have thought it was great.
Well, I think you know, you'd had Bosnia, and it had worked. It had broken the siege. You had Sierra Leone, as David just mentioned. I don't agree about Kosovo. I think Milosevic would still be there, or would have been there for many more years without the Kosovo intervention. So that's kind of worth it to me to get that region to move on, and now it's almost into the European Union. So I think there'd been, you know, the liberal interventionists, we were kind of riding a wave, and it all looked pretty good. And you put on top of that the tremendous disorientation of this country, particularly perhaps of New York City and its greatest newspaper, after the attack of 9/11. And, you know, we were sold a story that was false. We went to war on false pretenses, and it was a disaster. So I think that gave everyone, I hope, pause. Certainly gave me pause.
It gave you pause what?
Well, about interventionism and about...
It did.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, big time, yeah. Mm-hmm. It did, and as I said, I began, you know, when I began really thinking about North Africa, and I felt very, very strongly that, you know, the West going in there would just poison this, what was going on. So, but, I don't know, I think being an opinion writer, you've got to shift your position sometimes. So on Libya, I really felt I had to. And I think it's right. I think, you know, I think it would have been crushed. And now Benghazi's a rather amazing place. And I predict Gaddafi will be gone within 3 months.
Lindsay, I want to shift emphasis here a little bit and go back to Rwanda and back to your decision to testify before the International Criminal Tribunal.
Oh, gosh.
For Rwanda. Because something that you said at that time really caught my attention.
Oh, really?
I hope these are your words, because you've been quoted as saying this. You said, "It was not my responsibility as a journalist. My role as a journalist could even have been compromised by my testifying. But I also have responsibilities as a human being." Hmm. Could you say a little bit more about that, and particularly about how you saw that predicament that you were in? Because I think that, you know, that has implications for our reporting as well.
Yeah. And there's a split between British journalists and American journalists on this issue of testifying at war crimes tribunals. I felt that I was in a particular position. I was living in Rwanda. I was the only foreign correspondent living in Rwanda at the time that the genocide broke out. I'd been living there for 2 months. Then the moment the thing started, I mean, it's a long and complicated story, which I won't go into, but my career was in the doldrums, and I'd taken a couple of months working as an aid worker there, and then this thing happened, and so obviously I went back to being a journalist again and reported. But what it meant was that I was in a unique position, and most of the foreigners who were there did not go out and see what was going on, whereas I did go out to see what was going on, because that was what I felt I ought to do, and I reported. You don't, in your lifetime, hopefully you do not witness many genocides, and hopefully in your lifetime you are not frequently in a unique position to see and to be a witness. That happened to me by accident of fate, and I thought that I had to testify because I thought it was the right thing to do. And it's as simple as that.
And you didn't feel that your journalism was sufficient to make the statement that needed to be made?
No, I didn't. They kept trying to make me to go back and testify in endless different cases. I didn't testify against... it was in the first case that came up for trial. And what I was... I was testifying as a witness to the situation, that the killings were widespread and systematic, that it was in a situation of war and something else, but I can't remember what it was. But I wasn't actually testifying against an individual. And I did feel that would be different. And I had actually had sometime later, I did actually go and interview Karadzic after he was not supposed to be seeing any foreign journalists. And I undertook not to say where he was. Doesn't matter now. but he was in that horrible factory round the back in Parle. Anyway, I interviewed him, and but I had agreed not to say where he was, and I didn't say where he was, and I wouldn't have gone to a war crimes tribunal and testified and said where he was, because I had agreed not to do it. So I did draw a distinction between testifying in a general situation where I felt that I was in a particular important position and I should, and it was right to say something, and breaking my word as a journalist on something which was on background and not being, you know.
That's right.
But that's my morality, but other people would have a different view. That's fine.
But I think one of the things that you've just said is that that story had an impact on you that went beyond your responsibilities as a journalist. Roger, you haven't testified, right?
No, I didn't testify. I did cooperate with the tribunal on one case that I knew a lot about, which was a Serb concentration camp called Susica that I investigated at great length, and I did cooperate with one of the investigators on that, but I didn't testify.
But I do want to quote something that you said to Terry Gross in 2009 about Iran. You said, "One thing about journalism is that it can always surprise you." And I think I wrote in one column that we're supposed to be hardened and able to move on, and we're just voyeurs. We look at one story, then we look at another. And I think every now and again we just get ambushed by a story. And I've certainly been ambushed by Iran, and your subject turns the table on you and has you in its grasp rather than you deciding when you want to move on.
Yeah, that's true. It happens. It happened to me in Bosnia, which is why I wrote a book about it. Certainly happened to me in Iran, and I haven't written a book about Iran, but Iran was 2009 was an absolutely shattering thing to witness, and it's quite interesting with respect to reporting that Iran invited, you know, 500 journalists to witness this election, and I think that's ample evidence of the degree to which this just spun completely out of their control, because no sooner did the election happen than they started trying to throw all of us out, and I happened, because I'd been there earlier that year and I'd written some columns very strongly in favor of engagement with Iran, which earned me the wrath of certain sectors, particularly the U.S. Jewish community, they'd given me a somewhat longer visa, which meant that I was there for several days when there was hardly anyone left from the Western press. And it was agony to leave. I felt that, I mean, the brutality I was witnessing, and I felt if I thought of all kinds of things. I thought of going into hiding. I thought of maybe I could go to the British Embassy and somehow. I mean, I was completely kind of undone by it, and it took me quite a long time to recover. But, I mean, in a way, that's the great thing about journalism. I mean, if you were just kind of hardened and clinical and every story was the same, and all we were was serial voyeurs going from one yarn to the next. And I mean, for me, the greatest moments in journalism have been when I feel that, you know, your head and your heart come together, and you're able to write powerfully and evoke something in a way that moves people. I mean, that's what does it for me. I mean, Iran is. I mean, I do think 2009 in Iran was an important precedent of what's been happening in the Arab world, without question. And you saw the power of social media in Iran to propel that forward. And, you know, the Iranian people have been questing for a century for some kind of representative government. I mean, I think, you know, it will happen. Who knows when? But
David, do you feel that your best journalism is when your head and your heart are together, or do you trust your head more than your heart?
Leonard Cohen says somewhere, "I don't trust my inner feelings. Inner feelings come and go." I'm afraid I'm more of that view. The engagement. I what Roger talks about, I think Quincy agreed. I was nodding. There are stories that won't let you go. There are subjects that won't let you go, and you end up staying. I mean, I was in Banja Luka at the very beginning of the Bosnian War, and I was scared out of my wits, because not least because they kept threatening to kill me every day. And I stayed. And, you know, I'm not a particularly brave person, but I mean, there was no choice in some way. And there have been a couple of stories. But I've also worked in war zones where I really didn't. I mean, you know, I wish the civilians would stop dying. That's about the most I was willing to say about, you know, I was very much a plague on both their houses person, if you had my opinions. I didn't write so much about that. But, you know, the head and the heart, yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, the passions, there are stories that grip you. They're not necessarily, I mean, we shouldn't be too arrogant. I mean, they're sometimes the most important stories, and they're sometimes the most important stories to us. And sometimes those two things overlap and coincide, excuse me, and sometimes they don't. You know, I was for a time, you know, extremely interested in the fate of Savimbi's generals. Mm-hmm. Was that the most important story on the planet? No, but I sure it was to me for a while as I was trying to figure out what had happened to them. Some of them starved to death and stuff.
Sorry about that.
David, I know you have something to say about celebrity activism, and let's talk about that issue.
I probably shouldn't even bother you.
Let's talk about that issue with respect to Congo. I just was just today noticed this interesting article in the latest issue of Foreign Policy by Jason Stearns, who's been working on Congo for many years. And he starts out saying, "These are strange, exhilarating times to be working on the Democratic Republic of the Congo for the first time since full-fledged war broke out in the Central African country in 1996. The American public seems to be waking up to the brutality of the conflict there." And this is what's interesting. He goes on to credit, in part, the stream of celebrities who have become involved in the Congo, including Ben Affleck, Ryan Gosling, Angelina Jolie, Robin Wright Penn, and Javier Bardem. He says the mention of celebrity activism can provoke eye-rolling and smirks in policy circles. They argue this kind of knee-jerk mobilization leads to the dumbing down of issues, dangerous simplification, and the confusion of what is important with what is glamorous. But there is no doubt these grassroots endeavors have succeeded where more academic efforts have failed for decades, bringing the Congo to DC's attention. I'm not going to even give David a chance to weigh in on this issue just yet. Lindsay, you were in Congo in 2010.
Yeah, I was there last year, which was the first time I'd been there for about 10 years.
Is it your sense that this conflict really is coming to the attention of people who
so
are
what?
Attention?
What are they going to do about it? I mean, you know, it's the most benighted place on earth. I can't stand it. I mean, it just makes me so miserable every time I go, which is why I try and only go once a decade. Because I don't really know. I mean, it's lovely if they'd like to pay attention to it. But what are you supposed to do? I mean, there are the most hideous set of rebel groups which go around plundering and raping. There is the most hideous police force and army. And every now and then there's some sort of peace deal done and some bit of rebel force gets incorporated into the army and they all carry on doing the same things, which is, you know, plundering and taking the coltan and the cassiterite and all the rest of it. Now, there are some specific things which can be done about those minerals. And I think that there is some work which is slowly being done on trying to regulate those minerals, which are all smuggled out of the country, a lot of them through Rwanda and so on. But the idea that, I mean, that one of the problems in both journalism and the celebrity stuff is something must be done-ism. You know, we all go around and say something must be done. Well, that's fine, something must be done. But if you're going to say that, I think you have to be a bit more responsible and say what and by whom. And it has to be something which will actually make a difference.
And what would that be in Congo?
I have no idea.
But paying attention to conflict minerals is not a small thing.
No, that's a good thing. I agree. That's a good thing. I mean, I speak. Mine is, I understand, a council of despair. But when it comes to Congo, I do despair. Because I've been there. I spent so much time there in the 90s. And nothing seems to get any better. It's just ghastly. I don't know.
I think perhaps one way of kind of consoling ourselves or looking at it, which, I mean, I do think very slowly with great difficulty, you know, sounds corny, but, you know, the things have gotten a little better. I mean, imagine today a war in Europe, concentration camps, you know, mass rapes, mass killings, wide swathes of the population being, you know, deported, shelling of the, I mean, could that happen? I mean, it does seem...
It happened in Congo.
Yeah.
But it does.
It does, but...
I mean, it's just in slow motion. It's not in 6 years. It's in whatever, however long it's been. I mean, I don't think... I think it's, well, we must be very careful not to extrapolate from the European, and I would say the Near Eastern example.
But I think everything is much more visible.
Well, is it visible in Congo? I don't actually think it is.
It's been, well, no, I do think it's visible. It's been visible for a long time, but one of the things which is so upsetting is that its visibility doesn't seem to make a difference. Now, I still believe in reporting things for the sake of reporting them, and I went back to report on the issue of rape again last year because I thought it was... Because I thought... Basically, the reason I went back to do it again was because I felt guilty. Because two very young journalists came to me in my newsroom in London with some extremely bad footage which they shot there. And they were so committed and so idealistic about it all. And I just began to question myself about why I never went to Rwanda and Congo anymore, because I couldn't stand it. And I thought that I just couldn't live with myself. So eventually I went, and in the hope that that would quieten it down for a bit. And so I went and reported the issue again. And I went in with Margaret Wallström, who's the UN representative on sexual crime in conflict. And I do think that she is trying to do something. And there was a particularly egregious incident of mass rape last August, which was what she went to investigate. And there have been some arrests and so on. All of that is good. But then the broader point about the conflict in the Congo, which has... A lot of people have written about it, and a lot of people have broadcast about it. It doesn't get any better, and I don't know what should be done or who should do it. Maybe you do.
No, of course I don't. I think, I mean, without doing what you can all infer from what I've said already, what I think of celebrities. Don't hide your light under a bush. The harm it does is I think there's action in the simulacrum of action. And I think that it appeases consciences that Don Cheadle and George Clooney go to Darfur and come back with simplifications at a level. There's simplifications and simplifications, incidentally, in answer to something you raised earlier. I mean, there's simplifications that just simplify, and one has to simplify in telling any story. And there's simplifications that distort, as when in situations where, frankly, both sides are pretty much equally guilty of certain crimes, you decide to ignore the crimes of one side. The Rwandans, after 96, after 95, got a free pass in most places because they were thought to have suffered, and there was a kind of, the fix was in most places, that, which is not to say that the Tutsi weren't victims when it happened, but is to say that that government, what that government did in Congo, is, in my view, one of the great crimes of our times. I mean, so, you know, but people didn't say that because there had been this oversimplified view in which they were the people who'd saved the remnants of the Tutsi population from the genocide. They were, in effect, the heroes, and you don't knock the hero, at least in a non-revisionist movie. And, you know, That I think can be very bad. I think that's what Cheadle and Clooney have done in Darfur. I think the version of events in Darfur that they brought back has made things harder to understand, not necessarily simplified them, as sometimes is, of course, necessary.
Well, Bernard-Henri Lévy has now turned his attention from defending the people of Benghazi to defending Dominique Strauss-Kahn, so...
Yeah, I think he's equally reliable on Darfur. I won't talk with Libya, but Darfur and Strauss-Kahn, he's equally reliable.
I don't know that he's oversimplifying that case. I think he's adding a little bit of complexity to it that maybe goes beyond what makes sense.
Right.
All right, we've been dominating this. We have about a half hour left. There is a microphone here in the middle of the room, so come on up and, you know, pose questions.
I have two quick questions.
Yes, sir. And please identify yourself.
My name is Robert Ciccone.
And I kind of got the sense that you were a little bit cynical about the intervention in Libya. And my question to you is, I know it's a moving target and it's nebulous, but the R2P, Responsibility to Protect, in 1973, I think, is something that does have a context. And I think it should be viewed as a step forward more than anything else. That's one question. And my question to Roger, thank you, by the way, very much, is do you ever wonder in your idealism that you might follow, like, say, in the steps of Herbert Matthews in 1959 in his reporting on Batista in Cuba, which turned out to be less what he expected it to be? That's it.
Okay, David, defend your cynicism. Roger, defend your idealism. You first.
My problem with—I mean, it's partly because I was partly raised in France that I never understand why in this country pessimism is always called cynicism. I would simply cite for you Gareth Evans, a far greater defender of R2P than I am, as someone who's attacked R2P and will do it again in the pages of the National Interest next month. But Gareth has said that the way in which NATO has interpreted the mandate is pushing R2P to its limits, and if it goes much further, it may be the high water mark of R2P, not the beginning of the realization of the actualization of the reification, however you want to call it, of a new norm. So I scarcely think I'm alone in these anxieties. Another important figure who was in the Canadian government's efforts to create R2P was an academic who divides his time between mostly between Canberra and I can't remember which university in Canada, Ramesh Thakur, who's also been writing about how he thinks this has gone way too far. And I remind you about R2P that it's very rare that a doctrine, if it's useful to powerful people, remains in the shape its inventors wanted it to be. I give you the example of Christianity. I mean, how did the religion of women and slaves become the official religion of the Roman Empire? I think, you know, if R2P is useful to people, it will be distorted, as it was already when the then foreign minister of France, Bernard Kouchner, and the then foreign secretary of the United Kingdom, David Miliband, yes, wrote a joint op-ed in published simultaneously in The Guardian and Le Monde, calling in the aftermath of Cyclone Nargis, perhaps for the use of R2P for forcible intervention to provide humanitarian aid. I mean, these are real considerations. Incidentally, they did it at the very moment a Thai delegation was in Rangoon negotiating access for humanitarian aid.
Perhaps it was my idealism, if you want to call it that, that led me to underestimate the brutality of which the Islamic Republic in Iran proved itself capable in 2009. I still believe the Islamic Republic is immensely more complex thing than most people can be bothered to say or investigate. But I don't have, you know, any hesitation about, you know, where I've come down in Libya or, of course, you know, in Bosnia. I think people, you know, you talk about idealism and, you know, the desire of people to be free, the desire of people to have accountable government, the desire of people not to see a nation's wealth being plundered and sent off to Swiss bank accounts, desire of people not to see the sons of despots being promised their countries as fiefdoms. And, you know, I remember I was in Berlin 10 years after the wall fell, and I remember an East German, you know, leader of the of the uprising there, saying, we dreamed of paradise and we woke up in North Rhine-Westphalia. and that's, you know,
that's great.
Actually, North Rhine-Westphalia is not that bad, but it, you know, the adrenaline goes, and these are very slow processes. And then if you have taken an idealistic position, of course, your critics immediately come at you, especially if you're writing, you know, look at the cops and Muslims killing each other, look at this, look at that. And there'll be all kinds of things to look at, a synagogue getting burned in Tunisia. You know, there's going to be a price, but I say the cause, you know, outweighs that. I mean, let's shine a light into these societies. Let's get these forces out into the open. Let's get the give and take of open societies. And, you know, look where I'm speaking these words. And, you know, I have to know South Africa well because, in a way, that's where, I mean, my parents are from Johannesburg, and I spent a lot of my, you know, I was born in England, but I went back and forth a lot. And, you know, it's always amazed me with South Africa, you know, as my observation of apartheid and of the potential for absolute cataclysm, you know, when apartheid came to an end. You know, a number of people say, oh, look at South Africa, you know, look at the crime levels, look at the poverty, look at, you know, people want, it's a bit like that with Afghanistan. I mean, these are generational undertakings. Is the cause worthwhile? Yes. Will getting there be slow, incremental, painful, full of disappointments and crises? Yes. But that doesn't mean you should stop believing that we can make these societies better.
Lindsay, in your reporting from North Africa, did you feel any obligation to hint at what could go wrong there based on what you saw on the ground?
I don't think I was hinting at what could go wrong, but I was reporting as honestly as I could on the, well, obviously I've already talked about the inadequacy of the rebel forces, but also the problems of the transitional National Council, the de facto government, the fact that it doesn't really have any legitimacy, it's not elected, and the fact that there's a, in Libya, as in most of these societies, you've got a huge vacuum underneath the leadership, which is what the leadership has created, so that nobody could challenge them. So you've got a whole bunch of people trying to run eastern Libya who find it very hard to make decisions, and they're doing their best, but they're not politicians. They don't know how to make things happen and make things work because they have no experience of that. And they're, you know, and you have all sorts of different groups in society wanting different things. So I don't think I was hinting at what might go wrong, but I did try and report realistically on the problems which they were having.
I have to thank that gentleman for bringing up Cuba, which is a subject that is dear to my heart, but I guess we can't talk about Cuba today, really. Some more questions? Yes, ma'am.
Rachel Reed, you've talked mostly about a certain caliber of journalism, really, rather than mass media and TV news in particular. So I wondered whether you had thoughts about the more negative impact that could have. I'm thinking particularly in relationships to conflicts. My prejudice, I suppose, is I spent most of the last 3 or 4 years in Afghanistan, mostly for Human Rights Watch, but initially for the BBC, where we couldn't get anything on that wasn't bang bangs, that mm-hmm. wasn't a correspondent under threat, preferably looking quite dashing on the front line somewhere. Which is partly, I think, about me journalism, but also just about the shallowness of TV news generally. And I wonder if you think it does a disservice to foreign policy discussion and to the countries where the conflicts are happening.
Lindsay, one of the things I noticed about the reports that you, for which you won this award, is that they were all 4, 5, 6, 7 minutes long.
I bang on forever, you know. They can't shut me up. No, I mean, Channel 4 News is slightly different from other TV news in that we are an hour long every evening in Britain, and we do have longer stories and slightly more in depth, but we have a smaller audience. You know, we don't have a mass audience as big as in Britain. It would be ITV News and the BBC, and here obviously the networks. Yeah, I mean, you're right, of course, that there's bad journalism and good journalism, but I don't actually think that popular journalism has to be bad journalism. I think that ITV News is a pretty sort of tabloid, in a sense, TV news in Britain. And some of their correspondents are brilliant.
Yeah,
and sometimes I look at their stuff and I think, bugger, he said as much in 2 minutes as I've said in 5, and he said it better and he's made it clearer. So it just depends on the calibre of the journalist, and I don't think that the fact that something is is short is particularly bad. And yes, I know also what you mean about me journalism, and I, you know, we try and avoid that. We rise above. However, lots of people, you do surveys, and the audience like a sense of the person being there. They like to know who this person telling them the story is. You know, they want to know who that person is. And sometimes you have to use those techniques to try and get people to care.
But it's also you get people being excited. I mean, they were excited about the war in Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan.
Yes.
Crossing a different line, isn't
it? Well, I get very excited.
You were making a somewhat different point, which is that some of the most important things to report may not be all that exciting, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. Obviously.
So last year in Afghanistan, the debate was, in the US it was timetables, the impact of timetables withdrawal. In the UK it was how many helicopters are there. It wasn't actually about strategy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it happens. Some of the most important things in the world are deadly dull, and I don't report them. It's a problem. It is a problem.
Okay, go ahead. Go for it.
My name is Andy Kostich. I'm a botanist, but that will become relevant later in my question. One observation from the conversation so far, I would say that mainly the proper title of this session would be the impact of policy on reporting rather than reporting on policy. And because I can help myself think that if the esteemed panel, and now as a Bosnian I have to thank you because I believe I have a reason to thank you, would maybe not be doing what you did 20 years ago. If Bosnian Serbs, for instance, were more successful in keeping you out, if it wasn't part of Mr. Koyan said that the Arab Spring and having sort of this process take place from Tunisia to Egypt is in, I quote, should be our strategic goal. Who is we in this sentence? And therefore my question to you is, would you be able to imagine yourself now, knowing what you know now, doing the same thing in Bosnia 20 years ago?
Reporting the story the same way we reported it 20 years ago?
Actually, reporting it first and then reporting it the same way. Because if you take the case of Syria, what's going on, yes, on a smaller scale is very similar to what was happening in 92 in Bosnia. But the fact that they are managing to keep it closed, or as the Kareem pointed to Dabani in Sri Lanka, where there are allegations that actually tens of thousands of people were killed, does it mean that this is just down to the successful method of keeping the journalists out?
Well, it certainly helps. I mean, you know, as the old joke goes, stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage, but it's a good start. I think the fact they've kept us out of Syria, I mean, I'd go to Syria in a New York minute if I could get in. I used to know the country a tiny bit, and I would be, if you're asking me about Bosnia, would I have covered it the same way? Yes.
I think the point is that would they have allowed you to cover it? Would Serbs have been more effective?
Aha. Uh-huh.
Well, I mean,
they were just too incompetent.
They were shooting at us when we tried to get into the airport.
Yeah, they were doing that.
But I think you can. I think your point, though, is well taken, which is that I think that these governments have looked at all these different situations, and they have learned. And that is why the Sri Lankans, the Syrians, have done their best to keep all of us out, and the Iranians, when our visas came to an end, chucked us out. So yes, I think your point is well taken, and that is something that they have observed over the last 20 years. And so yes, if you did have the war in Bosnia now, maybe the Serbs would have made that an even greater priority and done as others have now done.
Of course, it does assume that the government has control of its territory.
Yes.
And, Gaddafi could not keep Lindsay out of Benghazi or Roger out of Benghazi.
Mm. Yeah.
You know,
go to the Cuba story, the Cubans have been absolutely brilliant over the years at analyzing your reporting, every single reporter who goes there, and those whose reporting is considered at least benign get invited back, and those whose reporting is considered critical find the door slammed shut, and it is an extremely effective way to control the coverage.
And in Iran, you know, they think, you know, your initial work is okay. They'll tend to probably allow you back and maybe back a third time, but they're also very uneasy with you getting to know the country too well. They like turnover. I mean, now there's nothing, but they don't like somebody who really gets to know the country well. And like David, I mean, if I got an Iranian visa, I'd be on a plane tonight. I mean, it's the most fascinating country. But
you said you wanted to write, you told Terry Gross you wanted to write a book about it. That probably sealed your chances
of ever writing a book about it.
No, they're not going to let you in if they think you're going to write a book about it.
Yeah, I don't think they'll allow me back. But you know, you never know. You never know with the Iranians. They're unpredictable people.
Yes, sir.
My name is Steve Adler. I dozed off a minute or two, and I hope I didn't miss anything too critical.
Sorry, we were so down.
Afghanistan was mentioned a few times.
What was mentioned?
Afghanistan.
Yes.
Some of you may have heard of it. Afghanistan was mentioned a few times. And last summer, there was an article, a cover story in Time magazine, in which the author of the article said that under the Taliban, women accused of adultery were stoned to death. The general image of the Taliban in that article, and in most articles about the Taliban, is that they were terrible misogynists. They went after women in particular and stoned them to death on essentially no evidence. The seminal report on Taliban stoning for adultery was by a Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times reporter who reported on the stoning to death of a man and a woman. Altogether, it appears that about a dozen people were stoned to death, roughly half of them men and half of them women, and the level of evidence was that you had to have four reliable male witnesses stand up in court and say that without breaking into the people's home, they actually saw Mr. A and Mrs. B going at it. Could you explain how the media have portrayed the Taliban as terrible misogynists, killing women on the basis of flimsy accusations, while the reality is that in order to execute anybody, they had to have an incredibly high standard of evidence, and in the case of adultery, four reliable male witnesses standing up in court and saying that they saw Mr. A and Mrs. B physically going at it?
Just to be sure I understood the question, are you suggesting that if there were enough evidence, stoning a woman to death would be a reasonable course of action?
I'm not interested in promoting anybody being stoned to death, but in the case of
but on the other
Kabul,
hand,
in the case of Kabul,
as against that,
we have a city that the Taliban controlled for 5 years, and in, with roughly 2 million people, that's 10 million person years. In Herat, we have 6 years and 500,000 people, so altogether 13 million person years. There was nobody stoned to death for adultery in those two communities during the Taliban control of those cities. So while ordinarily committing adultery in the road is not looked upon as a good thing, even in this society, that appears to what the to be what the Taliban were going after, people who were regularly doing it in a public place.
Yeah, okay.
Let me ask you this. Do you think the Taliban have been unfairly maligned in the media presentation of them?
Extremely. And one case in particular, as I brought to the attention of OSI last time I was here, is the case of the eradication of opium poppy growing. Now, most people here might be aware that they eradicated opium poppy growing. Most people are not aware of the extent that they reduced it by roughly 98.7% according to the UN data, and almost nobody is aware of how they did it.
Can I just screw you there? We covered that quite extensively, how they did, but unfortunately, their policy then changed. And it is now promoted, particularly in Helmand, where I have reported. And there is now a lot of opium poppy, which the profits of which do benefit the Taliban. So they did have a policy at one point of eradicating opium poppy, you're completely right. But that appears to have changed, and now a lot of the money which the Taliban use for purchase of weapons and so on comes from opium. But I think we get your point. Thank you.
Right. Just one last thing. Ahmed Rashid, a leading reporter on the situation in Afghanistan, claimed that the Taliban had wiped out opium in order to raise the price, claiming that the price had collapsed from $600 to $30 after 3 years of bumper crops. But his own data in his own book, aside from the UN data and other sources, show that there was never a price collapse, that the price remained at $30 for 20 years, and this was just nonsense. But it goes uncriticized, and the Taliban are the boogeyman of the world, thanks to the journalists such as yourselves.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes.
I think everybody heard me. I'd like to ask Roger Cohen about what you think might be going to happen to the two hikers who are still in prison in Iran. And well, the young woman who's come home.
Two hikers in Iran is Iran at its sleaziest. It has nothing to do with these hikers. It's just a simple, or not so simple, game of barter, poker game. I mean, Iran wants some people out from here in exchange for releasing them. At least that's my belief. When that will happen, how it will happen, I don't know. I think it's an outrage. And I know when it does happen, that the Islamic Republic will apologize to them and say, we didn't mean to, I hope you understand that, we didn't really mean to make your life difficult, and please come back to Iran one day, and it's all a terrible misunderstanding. And, these guys just wandered into something. They're stuck in a labyrinth, and the Islamic Republic is quite a labyrinth. And when it will end, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I imagine sooner rather than later, but I don't know.
Well, Iran right now is going through a very confusing, I think, to us, political conflict.
Yeah.
Between the hardliners and the really hardliners, and I'm not even sure which side is which. But
yeah, and the presidential election is beginning to loom. And,
My name is Dorothy Cota, and my question is really to you, the panel, as a viewer of news, although I do read the New York Times every day. But what struck me this year, for me personally, when the uprising started in Tunisia, was I sort of read several articles in the New York Times and followed a little bit on television news. But by the time we got to Egypt and the first demonstration, I became really enthralled with what was happening and what these people were doing, fighting for, their freedom. That's the way I would describe it. And so as the days went on, it became more and more powerful to me because of journalists reporting on a daily basis what was going on, to the point where you couldn't get enough of watching it, and particularly the reporting of Al Jazeera. And I'd also, you touched a little bit on Al Jazeera tonight, but I'd actually like to hear you talk a little bit more about their effect on news. And also, if we go back to 2001, when the government actually banned Al Jazeera took them off the New York Stock Exchange, and now we can't even get them on cable news channels. You've got to go to the internet to watch them. But yet, in my view, their reporting has been pretty extraordinary. But then to follow on to Libya, I've always been against any war, I think, in my lifetime. And I found myself for the first time actually supporting intervention into Libya. And that response also sort of shocked me. And part of it, I think, was because of the reporting that has been going on, along with the general media. So I'd just like you to respond to the, to all of that and how you really, how journalists really do affect and people who are viewing what is going on, and then them, in fact, changing their positions in terms of whether they support or don't support a particular conflict.
Well, you know, I just there's a lot there, but it's actually my sense that there was not tremendous popular support for intervention in Libya. In fact, the poll numbers show that it was lower than it was, you know, for a number of other conflicts. So you can't always assume that there is a direct relationship between the amount of attention that we give to a conflict or even the posture that we sort of take toward a conflict and the amount of public support for it. I think that's one of the, you know, that's a sort of a humbling thing for us to deal with. I remember a study that the Pew Center for People in the Press did that found that compared the number of column inches and air minutes spent on the covering the war in Bosnia with the level of public support for intervention, and there was basically no relation at all.
That's right.
So that's just something to keep in mind. I don't know if anyone else has.
Can I just say something about Al Jazeera, because I think it's a very interesting point, because you've got Al Jazeera in Arabic as well as Al Jazeera in English, and Al Jazeera in Arabic is a much more important one from where I come from, because that is where people in the Arab world are seeing, that's what they're watching, and they're watching Arabia and others as well. But it has been a tremendously important force since it began, 5 years ago. And a lot of these autocratic Arab governments hate it, and they periodically ban it and so on. And arguably, it's much more important in terms of changing the reality of what goes on than anything that we do, because it affects public opinion across the Arab world, and it also affects the governments. And I think we're only just... Well, less so, because not very many people watch it here. And, a few people who know about it will watch it, but not that many people, and certainly not compared to the impact which it has across the Arab world. But Al Jazeera in English is also becoming much more popular across Asia and in Africa and so on. So, yeah, I mean, it's certainly in many of these places, it's certainly overtaken BBC, CNN and so on. It's a tremendously important force, and on the whole, its reporting is a very high standard.
Yeah, and to just follow up, the particularly in countries like Indonesia and Malaysia, the English service has... Really, I mean, I'm on it occasionally, and I sort of see, they show you data when you go into the studio here in Washington, and, you know, they're very influential in that part of Asia, the English service.
We actually get it on cable in Washington, D.C.
Well, it is becoming a little more widely available, which would be good.
And I can say at NPR, throughout this whole Middle East conflict, all the TV sets at NPR in the part that's paying attention to foreign news were tuned to Al Jazeera, not CNN. CNN was not seeing it all. We were totally paying attention to Al Jazeera.
Is the United States government still against Al Jazeera, basically? I mean, that was their real premise in 2001. They really, in fact, they did call it a terrorist organization. So, I mean, has that changed over time? Has it changed because of the administration have changed? What?
I don't know the answer to that. Another question? I think we have time for one more question, and then you might want to grab a bite to eat.
Okay.
No more questions?
No more
questions. Thank you. You guys are terrific.
Thank you. Thank you a lot.